Should America's commander-in-chief know how old the Earth is? Should your congressperson know how many millions make a trillion? This hour, look at why there should be more science in politics. Sean Otto tells us why a presidential science debate can help. Retired Congressman and scientist Vern Ehlers is here to make the case for more scientists in government. And did you know there is a test that can detect attitudes and biases that you didn't even know you had? We'll talk about a new study where researchers tapped into hidden racial attitudes toward presidential candidates, and the results may surprise you. And we'll tell you how you can take the test yourself. All coming up after this break, so stay with us. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If the polls are a good indicator, the economy, jobs, the deficit, health care, and education are likely to be the issues that weigh heavily on voters' minds when they head to the polls in November. But researchers say there may be another factor that influences the presidential vote this election cycle, and that's racial attitudes. 4 years after Americans elected their first black president, a new study shows that it is premature to count race out as a factor. Dr. Tony Greenwald was lead investigator for the study and is a professor of psychology at the University of Washington. He joins us from KUOW in Seattle. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks. Thank
you. You're welcome. Why do a study on racial attitudes in 2012 after we've had, you know, the election of President Obama in 2008? You wouldn't think this is a big issue anymore.
Well, it was an open question whether there's race attitudes are still affecting Americans' political attitudes or not. We certainly found that they were in 2008. Obama won, but he actually won despite race biases that were opposing him. Obama lost the white vote by 55% to 45%, which is a rather large margin. So we did a similar study, much larger this year, just to see what was happening.
And what did you find out?
We found that the level of race bias indicating preference, and this was in the Republican primaries, we were asking about support for the different Republican candidates and comparing them with Obama. We found that this was predicted by race attitudes of several kinds. We measured race attitudes in a few different ways, such as asking people explicitly what they thought of black and white, and a lot of our people in our sample thought that black and white are just equal. They have no racial preference. But we also use the implicit association test, which gives us a measure of implicit bias. We sometimes call it automatic white preference. And that's something that many more people have.
So you found that even though people thought they were unbiased, when you tested them, they actually showed bias.
Yes. And we looked especially at people who are most likely to think they are lacking in bias, such as these self-described egalitarians, also political liberals. Our sample, being an internet sample, is not surprising that it was a majority of liberals. And we found that the implicit race attitudes of these liberals and the egalitarians predicted their warmth toward Republican candidates.
So in other words, many white and non-white voters will unconsciously vote against President Obama because of his race, but when asked, they'll give a reason other than race.
That's very likely. This is very hard to tease apart, and our method works by measuring things that you can't really ask people about because they don't know. And we think it's one of a number of factors that play into determining vote, but it's a strong enough factor so that it can actually affect a significant percentage of the vote.
Among Republican candidates, when you polled them, did you see similar racial attitudes towards Herman Cain?
Cain was very interesting because Democrats actually, with racial bias, either explicit, meaning they were not egalitarian, or implicit, preferred Cain to Obama. Those who opposed Obama excuse me, their preference for Cain was predicted by their racial attitudes, meaning people who are opposing Obama on the basis of race actually indicated that they preferred Cain, which indicates that they're strong enough against Obama that they would even support Cain. But when we compared Cain against other Republican candidates and looked just at people who were supporting Republican candidates, the racial attitudes strongly predicted preference for the white candidates.
Mm-hmm. But the test itself isn't a measure of racism.
It is definitely not a measure of racism. We are very clear to emphasize that this measures something that is perhaps unconscious. In any case, most people are unaware of it, and it is possessed by a large proportion of the American population, people who do not at all think of themselves as racist, and we don't think they're lying to us when they say they have egalitarian racial beliefs.
Why is it that they're out of touch with their subconscious? I mean, this is too big a question to ask. It may take years to answer for any person, but do you have any guesses on that?
Often their explicit race beliefs have been shaped by factors other than the culture as a whole, but our media, entertainment, news, literature, history are filled with negative references to African Americans compared to white Americans. And that environment, the sort of intellectual air we breathe, is so full of negative associations with African Americans that this gets picked up by the brain and stored as these associations that we can measure. But people aren't actually aware that they have this. They often explicitly reject it. They certainly don't want to have it. But nevertheless, it can act on them and it can affect their behavior. It can produce produce discomfort in interracial interactions, and that's something that all by itself is likely to produce some unintended discrimination.
But a lot of people would say, you know, people still have racial biases. Why even study that? We know that there are racial biases around.
Well, the history of race bias in the United States has been very interesting. In the last 50 years or so, partly due to the legalities of civil rights law, overt racial bias has dropped way down. Very few people indicate any kind of opposition to desegregation in schooling or residential integration. But at the same time, racism survives in forms that are measured indirectly, including by our test and by some other tests that are more subtle, trying to measure things that are called modern racism or symbolic racism. So racism has not disappeared, but it has taken a very different form, such a different form that we no longer want to use the word racism for it. We call it implicit race bias or implicit race attitude.
And now that we have Mitt Romney as the presumptive Republican nominee, are you going to continue your surveys?
Yes, we are continuing by removing the other Republicans from our survey, focusing on Romney and Obama, and trying to get at factors that will allow us to understand more why we observe these correlations that we consistently observe.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the test. What is the implicit association test? How does that work?
This is a procedure that's sort of fun to play with. You can take it yourself on the internet. It's a procedure that involves four steps. And first, you're asked to rapidly classify white and black faces by pressing a left side computer key for black faces and a right key for white faces. That's an easy task. Second, same type of task, but now you're pressing the left key for unpleasant words, words like hurt or failure, and the right key for pleasant words like joy and love. That's an easy task, too. Then it begins to get more difficult. We combine the tasks, the third step. Now the left key is for either white faces or unpleasant words, and the right key is for either black faces or pleasant words. This combination of two easy tasks can be quite difficult. When I first did this, which was in the mid-1990s, I was amazed to discover how slowly I was going at the task. I was also making errors. Then there's the fourth step. We switch the sides of the faces. Now it's the black faces and unpleasant words on the left, the white faces and pleasant words on the right. This turned out to be surprisingly easy for me. I could go fast, few or no errors. This is how I discovered that I have this implicit race bias myself. And as we continued to study this, I found that I was far from alone. About 75% of the subjects in our research and the people who take this test on the web show a similar pattern to what I showed.
And we actually have a link to how to take the test up on our website at sciencefriday.com. People can try it out for themselves. What other things can you measure with this test besides bias in that way?
It's been very useful in measuring gender stereotypes. For example, it shows that there are strong stereotypes that associate male with science, female with arts, and we found that this is correlated in different countries. The strength of this implicit stereotype is what we call it, predicts male-female differences in performance on standardized tests that are administered every few years. There's a gender career stereotype that associates women with family, men with careers. And you'd think that this is something that men would show, but women would reject. Actually, the implicit association test shows that women have this stereotype, this implicit stereotype, even a little more strongly than men. And we found in research, others have found in research, that this stereotype is associated with women experiencing difficulty in the workplace. It's sort of a force inside their head that gives them a source of conflict or a feeling of discomfort in career situations.
Speaking of inside your head, can you tell anything about people's mental health from the test?
There is now a very active research by clinical psychologists on this, and there is a site that's available called Project Implicit Mental Health at which people can take these tests. I think it can be found on the same page that you will have a link to, but I'm not sure about that. And one of the uses of this test has been to predict suicide risk. This has been very surprising research that an implicit association test actually predicted risk of reattempting suicide more effectively than self-report characterizations of the likelihood of recurrence.
And one quick question, I have about 30 seconds. If you found racial bias with its test, how is this test not a predictor of racism or measure racism?
It's correlated with overt racism, but it's very different. And the difference is that people are unaware of this. They don't want it very often. They certainly don't endorse it. And it's what clinical psychologists or psychiatrists call a dissociation. It's like two separate things in the head, one egalitarian and open, the other biased.
All right, Dr. Greenwald, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ira.
Tony Greenwald, psychologist at a professor of psychology at the University of Washington. We're going to take a break, and afterwards we're going to come back and ask the candidates in the science debate, what would you ask them about science? Stay with us. We'll be right back. Ira here, and I want to thank you for listening and for making this podcast possible. And if you like what we do, our radio show, podcasts, Facebook, Twitter, and more, if you appreciate that and you can afford to pitch in, I invite you to contribute whatever you can by pressing on the donate button on your smartphone or iPad app, or going to our website at sciencefriday.com and making a tax-deductible donation. Thank you. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Every member of the House of Representatives and a few from the Senate, about a third of the Senate, I believe, is up for a re-election this year. There will be hundreds of debates, local and national. Candidates will be asked questions about unemployment, the deficit, gay marriage, budget cutting. But will any of them be asked about their opinions or their knowledge of science and technology? We have politicians who claim global warming is a hoax, others who don't believe in evolution. Shouldn't we want to know what the candidates know about the basic things in science? Will any moderators of the inevitable presidential debates even ask one question about science? These are some of the reasons that a grassroots coalition of scientists, engineers, and science advocates is calling for a televised presidential science debate. Their goal, for candidates to give us more than canned responses and for voters to make an informed decision in November with informed meeting, knowing something about the candidates' views about science. Joining me now to delve into some of these questions, Sean Otto is the CEO and co-founder of ScienceDebate.org, the group trying to organize a presidential science debate. He's also author of Fool Me Twice, Fighting the Assault on Science in America. He joins us from Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Welcome back to the program, Sean.
Thanks, Ira.
Dr. John Allen Paulus is a professor of mathematics at Temple University and author of several books, including Innumeracy and A Mathematician Reads the Newspaper. He joins us from Philadelphia. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Paulus.
Thanks much.
And former Congressman Vern Ehlers is a former Republican congressman from Michigan. He's also a physicist. He joins us from Grand Rapids. Welcome to Science Friday.
It's a pleasure being here.
Thank you. Sean, I remember you calling for a science debate back in 2008.
Yes.
No one wants to listen about that, do they?
No. Well, the candidates did participate online, but they were scared to do it on television. And I think it's probably just because it's something new.
Mm-hmm. Are you again looking for a TV debate this year then?
Yes, we are. It's a really important way of bridging the science gap that is emerging as science begins to influence more and more aspects of our lives and lies at the center of more and more of our unsolved major public policy challenges. And yet the people that we're electing often don't seem to have much knowledge of science or the ability to tell the difference between a knowledge-based argument and one that just sounds good.
Mm-hmm. John Paulus, in 2000, you proposed presidential candidates take a Who Wants to Be Scientifically Literate quiz. What was the idea behind that?
The idea behind that was just to determine, some limited extent at least, whether politicians could think on their feet, whether they could solve simple puzzles, make simple estimations. I mean, high-tech firms routinely ask little puzzles of prospective employees, and yet our number one employee, arguably, never has to respond in real time to a question that's not canned. I mean, it's very easy to plug into, well-memorized, well-rehearsed sets of answers.
Congressman Ehlers, do you think any Congress people would, be in favor of talking about science?
It all depends on the member of Congress. There are very, very few scientists there right now. I recall, I believe, since I've left, there's only one in the House of Representatives, and that's Russ. I'm blanking on his name right now, but he's from
Rush Holt from New Jersey.
Rush Holt, yes, of course. I had a strange illness last year, and I lost various cells in my brain memory. And so it's very frustrating to not recall someone. I know him very well.
I wish I could use that as my excuse.
Yeah, at least I have an excuse. At any rate, Rush is a very fine person. I worked well with him. He was obviously a Democrat and I'm a Republican, but that didn't matter to us. We both worked together very closely. But I know why I wanted to mention, Sean, I really appreciate your effort to arrange the debate on the presidential candidates. I appreciate you writing the book you did. I rushed right out and bought it. And we all have to do that kind of effort. But it's no surprise to me, no presidential candidate is going to want to enter a debate involving much mathematics or science. They just don't understand it. They don't know anything about it. They may have taken one course on it in high school. And the last thing they want to do is publicly display their ignorance. So you have to go at it at some other avenue rather than direct contact where they would be saying things without studying them or knowing them.
But if you ask some of the simplest of questions, like how old is the Earth? That would tell you a lot about the candidate, many different things about the candidate, would it not?
Yeah, right. But for certain candidates, their belief in the Bible would overwhelm any knowledge of mathematics they might have. They might be influenced more by their religious beliefs than they are by any knowledge of math.
But wouldn't that be useful to know that?
Yes, it would, but only if you're wanting to judge candidates on the basis of their religious beliefs. I would be more concerned about will they understand the financial structure of the United States government, and will they be able to tell by themselves what is a dangerous direction to take and what is a safe direction to take? And that requires far more sophistication than knowing the age of the earth. As you say, it may be of interest to a lot of people to know what their religious beliefs are and how that affects their thinking. But I'd be far more concerned about how they are able to deal with all the intricacies of government, particularly from the standpoint of science and the mathematics of the budget. But I really want someone up there who is sharp in all fields of knowledge, not just science and mathematics, but just a well-rounded, well-educated individual, able to deal with all the many issues that come before the President of the United States. And if they can't do that, I don't care which party they're from, I wouldn't support them.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Give us a call. Tell us what questions you would like to see the candidates address. And we'll get to your calls. We have already asked this online, and we got some interesting questions. One that I mentioned before is how old do you think the Madge Minor Russell wrote how old do you think the world is? That was right at the top of the list. Clay Bunyard wants to know: do you know what the scientific meaning of theory is versus hypothesis? Steve Rawley, describe the scientific method. Explain how it differs from faith. Sean, we've been talking about the presidential debates, but you could easily, you know, what every member of Congress and what is it, a third of the Senate is up for re-election. You could easily take this to your hometown, could you not?
And
ask your local candidate these questions.
There's two different ways to do that, actually. One is asking them these sorts of questions, not necessarily how old is the earth, but what their position is. You know, we're more interested in their positions on the big science policy questions. How are they, you know, whether they understand that climate change is occurring according to scientific knowledge and the measurements that we're doing of nature, and if so, what their plan is to deal with that, or how do we deal with our slipping science and math education standards, or since science and education or science and technology drive so much of our economy, about 60% of our economic activity right now in one way or another, how are we going to ensure our continued innovative dominance? There's another way to do it, too, and that's to ask them to take something called the American Science Pledge, which you can find on my website at seanotto.com. And that is a pledge to base public policy decisions on evidence instead of opinion or belief.
Yeah, and this is Vern again. I hate to I'm not trying to dominate this, but I would be very interested in what they know about the importance of science, that science is the scientific research is the basis of the economy because it's the research that leads to new discoveries. New discoveries lead to manufacturing of new products, and that leads to jobs. And if you're not going to fund basic science research, you're not likely to improve the economy as much as you could with allocating funds to research. I would also be interested in how much a presidential candidate knows about the National Science Foundation. That's a very good question to ask them. What is the National Science Foundation? What do they do? Would you support increased funding for them in an effort to improve the economy? And a question like that would really wake them up to some of these issues.
John Paulos, what questions would you ask? Would you want to be moving into what advice they might take from other people?
I think I'd also like to ask a few specific questions about elementary arithmetic. I mean, if there's a small town and a new policy would result in, let's say, a $2,000 reduction in the mean tax bill, but the median reduction would be $100, what does that say about the town? And if they don't know the difference between mean and median, it's hard to see how they could, as the congressman said, understand the financial structure of the United States. Or just the simple questions, what fraction of the world is American? Would you be more upset about a $3 million earmark that's somehow relevant to a hot-button issue or a $50 billion new weapon system? So you have to know the relative magnitude of millions and billions.
Right.
So, I mean, simple questions like that, if you ask general questions, they'll kind of plug into bromides and platitudes, and it'll sound good. But when you press them, what comes out won't be consistent with their general platitudes anyway.
Let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Kate in Santa Fe. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Hi, Vern. It's Kate Liss. I live in New Mexico now.
Really?
I was telling the screener that I was the sacrificial Democratic candidate against Vern in 2002, and I'm an engineer and environmental lawyer, and so we were joking about what a nerdy candidacy this was, what a campaign it was, but I would like to know if the president understood anything about risk assessment. I deal in environmental cleanup all the time, and if you don't have any way to assess relative risk, if you don't understand that concept, you're so easily swayed by politics versus science, whether you're on the environmentalist side or the industrial side. It skews it so widely from one end to the other, and nothing really ever gets accomplished.
Good question. Risk assessment.
I think that's very important. Former Vice President Cheney had his famous 1% doctrine. If there's a 1% chance of a terrorist attack, you have to act as if it were a certainty. On the other hand, if there's a 99.9% chance of global warming, you have to say, well, many people say, well, maybe it's not established. So politicians in particular too often use numbers as providing decoration and not as providing real information. They don't interpret them literally. They just kind of decorate sentences with numbers.
All right, Kate, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the science policy and with Sean Otto, Dr. John Allen Paulos, and Vern Ellers. 1-800-989-8255 is a number. Congressman, you are a Republican, as you say, and it's certainly a different mood in Congress since you were there. How would you explain the views of the candidates on climate change and evolution in the Republican primary?
Well, it was never an issue when I ran, and in my district, I was pretty well known, and that's one thing. You know, I have encouraged a lot of scientists to run for office, and they want to jump right in and run for Congress. It's very hard to win that way unless you have previously established a good local reputation. In my case, I was a reluctant candidate initially. I got involved just because of a local solid waste problem, and it was going nowhere. And so I was persuaded by friends, since I'm very environmentally minded. They said, look, a scientist with an environmental interest would be the ideal candidate. So I ran for the county commission. It was an eye-opener to me, but I basically solved the solid waste problem in our community. And many of the people who know this are grateful to it to this day. But from there, I went to the state house, was there a few years, then the state senate, and then ran for Congress. By then, almost everyone in the congressional district knew me and knew about my work, and they weren't the least bit interested about my scientific views. They just knew that I worked hard, that I kept contact with the constituents, and that I was a good guy, and so they voted for me. So for scientists who are thinking of running, recognize you can try to run on the basis that you're a scientist and you'll add a lot to the Congress, and you might win. But basically, it involves getting known in the community first and being willing to work for the good of the community without remuneration in many cases. And they see you at work. They see your name in the papers. They say, hey, you know, this guy knows something. And it's much easier to get elected to the Congress then. So I encourage anyone who's thinking about running, you know, get active at the local level. Run for the school board, the city commission, whatever, and just work your way up the ladder. In most states, it's not a full-time job until you reach Congress. So you can continue with your professional work. You just have to spend a couple evenings a month, and you can do some really good things for your community, but also you are building a base for a congressional run if that's what you want. I really think it's important that scientists, even if they don't want to run for office, get involved. And my first involvement arose out of a meeting of the American Physical Society in San Francisco some years ago. And at that time, I was at the Joint Institute for Laboratory Astrophysics at the University of Colorado. And I went to the meeting in San Francisco, and Mike McDermott, who was a chemist from the Hanford plant, he was a congressman from the state of Washington. And he gave a great speech and said, now, why are you all sitting on your hands? Why aren't you politically involved? He said, I want you to go home and write your congressman and offer to give free scientific advice for him.
All right, I got you started. I got it. We have to take a break. We'll be right back with Sean Otto, John Lawrence, Alan Paulus, and Congressman Vern Ahlers.
Got a hankering for a bit more conversation? You didn't like what you heard. You want to hear more of it? Well, you can keep the chat going at Science Friday's Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/SciFry. Or you can tweet us all week long at SciFry. That's at SCIFRI.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about making science a topic of discussion in this election year. What kinds of questions would you ask the president or maybe even members of your Congress? And we're actually conducting a poll here, and we would like to ask you to participate in that poll. And if you go over to our website at sciencefriday.com, we've already started the poll and sort of narrowed down the questions. And we want you to vote in there for the kinds of questions that you'd like. See the poll there, choose which of those questions there, and go for it and tell us what you would like to see. Also, you check out the link to a poll, Science Debate 2012, Science Debate 2012 at sciencefriday.com, and you can cast your vote right at that spot. We're talking with Sean Otto, CEO and co-founder of sciencedebate.org, Dr. John Allen Paulus, who's professor of mathematics at Temple, and former Congressman Vernon Ahlers, a Republican from Michigan, one of the last few scientists in Congress, a physicist. Our number, 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Sean, have you ever tried to get through to any of the people who ask any of the questions at these televised debates to even get one or two science questions in there?
We have. We've been talking actually this time around to a couple of the different television networks about that. Not to the moderators directly, but to the different networks. And there's a little bit more interest this time around than there was last time, I have to say. Partly that's just because so many science issues have become so politicized, and much more of the presidential discussion is focusing on questions of science.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones and see what the topics come up there. Shirley in Iowa City. Hi, Shirley.
Good afternoon.
Hey,
my concern has been, and there's been a lot in Congress about legislation regarding medicine and also the Internet, which there seems to be very little understanding of either of these things in Washington. And it's sort of like legislators are acting like doctors. I think the president also needs to have a kind of a good basis in both of these topics. So I think we need questions that kind of reveal whether they have any understanding of this at all.
I remember a time when Vern, this is Sean here, had to rush to the floor to clarify for a member that ATM research shouldn't be cut. He thought the banking industry should pay for that. and the member didn't realize that that stood for asynchronous transfer mode, which was an internet protocol.
Yeah. Well, if I may respond to that, that's the point I was getting at before we had the break. The most important thing a scientist can do is think about running for Congress and preferably run for Congress, because you just have to be there. You know, I was sitting in my office listening to the floor debate when this person talked about cutting funds for the National Science Foundation for two reasons. First of all, because they were going to do research on ATMs, and secondly, because they... Well, I won't get into too much detail, but the point is, I was right there. I could rush to the floor. I could speak against what the previous speaker had said, and I tried to avoid him becoming a laughingstock, but every scientist who was listening indeed thought it was a laughing matter. But in my story about how to, earlier I was telling about how I became involved directly, was when Mike McDermott spoke at American Physical Society meeting and said, write your congressman and offer to give him scientific advice, no charge. And so I got back home and wrote a letter to Jerry Ford, who was my congressman, offered to put together a science advisory committee in my area, and told him I would pick scientists from several disciplines. We'd meet with him whenever he wanted to and answer any questions he had. I dropped a letter in the mail and thought, oh, well, in a week I'll get a response saying, thank you for your letter, we'll keep you in mind, et cetera. But instead, the day they got the letter, I got a call from Jerry Ford's chief of staff saying, hey, thanks for the letter. Jerry's all excited about it. Can you give us some idea of the structure? And I said, well, I'm coming to Washington next week for a science meeting. I'll be happy to meet with him. And it was, I knew Jerry just slightly, but not very well. So I got there and met with Jerry and his chief of staff, and I thought a very telling moment was, and I said, we decided how we'd arrange the committee, how it would operate, and so forth. And I just appreciated Jerry's attitude, and I asked one tough question. I said, do you want me to have the scientists on the committee be all Republicans or a mix, regardless of their political view? And his aide immediately popped up and said, oh, they should be Republicans, of course. And Jerry said, I don't see why. He said, pick the best people you can. And we had a very good relationship. We'd meet with Jerry at least quarterly, and if he had a tough issue, he would ask us to meet with him again. And it's the old story. You have to be there at the right time to act. And I encourage every scientist to make that same offer to their member of Congress or to their U.S. senator or even their state legislatures. You can grumble all you want about those idiots in the Congress, but if you're not helping to educate the idiots, you're not doing your job.
But you also have to have someone like Jerry Ford who is interested in the truth.
Yeah. Well, if you don't, then you should run against the congressman you have.
Yeah, this is Sean here. I want to reemphasize that point, that we've kind of gotten away from science in our public dialogue because, in part, scientists have gotten silent over the last 40, 50 years. And the voice of faith and values is important in discussing public policy dialogue, and the voice of economists and industry leaders are important, but the voice of scientists are also important, especially when so many of our big challenges that we're stuck on revolve around it. So we really do need scientists as part of that process, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they have to run for office. Like Vern said, they could volunteer to form a science advisory committee. They could just even show up at local school board meetings, and when talk of teaching creationism in science class comes up, or of dumbing down standards on geophysics and telling people that there's a scientific controversy about climate change when there isn't, they could speak up and educate school board members and members of the public about why that is.
Dr. Parlos, you agree?
I do agree. I think part of the resistance is just the word debate, science debate. I mean, if maybe it should be billed as a science discussion. I mean, what's important is not so much science as a noun, but science as an adverb. How do you think scientifically, whatever the topic? That's why I think, kind of, in a sense, trick questions or questions regarding math or whatever, that it require them to, like, think through a problem on estimating or scaling or sequencing. I mean, not so much it shouldn't be an SAT test, but just to see how they think analytically. And that's, again, that's not surprising that you'd meet resistance because politicians are used to, as I said, you're just giving canned, rehearsed answers. But And I agree with the congressman. It behooves people with a scientific and mathematical background to engage themselves in the public domain. It's kind of scary in a way because if you just forthrightly say something that's true, you're liable to incur the wrath of all kinds of people who feel that what you've said has contradicted their religious or cultural beliefs. And it's also, in a sense, harder to be a politician than it is to be a scientist, and less fun. I mean, to be a politician, you've got to assuage and placate various disparate constituencies, and that's harder to do. Science is fun. Math is fun. So, on top of that, you sometimes have to incur the snide remarks of colleagues who directly or indirectly chastise you for trying to, commune with the hoi polloi, so to speak. I mean, they're not necessarily mine.
Can I pick up on something, John?
Excuse me. Go ahead.
I just wanted to underscore.
I had a little bit of this when I would meet with scientists, and many of them would basically say something along the lines of, "Whatever led you to go to Congress? I mean, what was wrong with your mind that you decided to do that?" And scientists tend to look down at it, and I thought it was a great opportunity to continue educating, which I had done for many years as a professor.
Interesting. Sean, did you want to jump in there?
I wanted to just underscore what John was saying, that there's really no politician that is going to be excited about debating anything to do with science. Politicians are in business when they're running for election to do one thing, and that's to get votes, to get elected. And if they don't see a payoff for them in this, and if they see undue risk, they're not going to want to do it. There's a reason why in 2008 we set up a science debate at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, and the candidates turned us down and instead did a faith forum at Messiah College. And that's because they perceived a lot of noise and a lot of votes at stake from that community. They didn't hear anything comparatively from the science community, even though there are millions of scientists working in the United States.
So you're saying that scientists could become a voting bloc or an interest that they would have to pay more attention to.
And to that, you should add the engineers and the MDs. As it is, quite a few MDs run for the Congress already and win. And in many cases, they are the only scientifically trained people in the body. And you know as well as I that medical doctors are very, very well trained, but they are not necessarily that adept at science or know that much about science. And so it's important to have a broad spectrum, as I say, of scientists, engineers, and medical doctors or others with scientific background working in the Congress, and then you can have quite a bit of clout. When I was the only one there, it was tough. I just had to go around continuously talking to people about the issues and educating them. It took an immense amount of my time, because you can't do it through floor debate. It has to be one-to-one conversations. So the more scientifically trained people we can get in the Congress, the better. It doesn't have to be physicist and chemist. It can be a lot of different professions representing it.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Sean Otto, Dr. John Paulos, and former Congressman Vernon Ehlers. 1-800-999-8255 is our number. How many scientists or how many engineers, mathematicians think of Congress or working in government as a career path for them?
Not too many. I think another problem is kind of the macho nature of being a politician. The can-do, I can solve this, and it's not unrelated to American exceptionalism, so-called. And science is about, sometimes at least, about constraints. And constraints are part of science, and politicians don't want to say, well, I can't do this and that because of that and this. So, but I can do anything, and it's better if I'm, kind of vague and don't specify the, limitations or constraints, which in some sense I know exist, but I don't want to stress them much.
Do you think Jimmy Carter's background as a scientist, knowing what you just said, hurt him as a politician?
Possibly. I don't quite buy into the fact that he had such a great scientific background. He had a bachelor's degree, and he studied under he worked under Rickover, but he didn't have a bachelor's degree in nuclear engineering. But science. Another factor is the diffidence the skepticism in science. You have to suspend belief, and it has to be shown to you. Whereas politicians have to always be certain. And the problem is that most things aren't very certain. And scientists will say, well, that might be, that might not be. We don't have enough evidence yet, or this or that. Nobody, that's not a way to inspire voters to say, maybe.
Hmm. I think it was Rush Holt who was quoted when he got into Congress as saying, when I was a scientist, facts meant everything and illusions meant nothing. And when I became a politician, illusions meant everything and facts meant nothing.
Well, there's another aspect to that, too. Most of the work I did with my fellow colleagues was not on the floor, not even in committee meetings so much, although that was more important than anything I said on the floor. But the social context, almost every night there's a fundraiser for someone or another, and I made a habit of trying to go to those and make myself available to others to talk in a very friendly, informal manner about science and about science issues. Mm-hmm. I recall one time someone who was dead set against any ideas of global warming, I happened to be end up sitting next to him at a table, and he said, Vern, is there carbon dioxide in this room? And I said, yes, and explained where it was from, et cetera. And we ended up with quite a discussion about CO2 and what caused it, where it comes from, how it affects people and things. And I think in that 20-minute conversation, I certainly made him doubt his opinion that global warming was just a farce. He realized there was a scientific basis for it, and it made him much more cautious from that time on in making public comments about it. And he gave up a lot of his preconceptions. So that one-to-one activity that you can do outside of the chamber and the committee room is very, very important. And that's why you just have to be there. And so the more scientists we get there in the Congress, the better.
All right. We're going to end on that hopeful note. You've run out of time. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for taking time to be with us, talking with former Congressman Vernon Ehlers, a Republican from Michigan, a physicist, Dr. John Allen Paulos, professor of mathematics at Temple University, author of several books, including Innumeracy and a Mathematician Reads the Newspaper, Sean Otto, CEO and co-founder of ScienceDebate.org, and author of Fool Me Twice, Fighting the Assault on Science in America. And Sean Otto also has a guest blog on our website, and our website at sciencefriday.com, where we also are conducting a poll. It's poll Science Debate 2012 at sciencefriday.com. Our program senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our associate senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Misha Sarin-Anand is our producer. Luis Quevedo is our Spanish language producer. Sam Flato, our production assistant. Neil Rauch, our technical director at the controls here in New York. Our iPhone app is produced by Pastime Software. Wayne Hoxie does our Android app. Thanks for listening. I'm Ira Flato.